Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Melissa Topshire with today's headlines. SCOTUS hears arguments in the January 6 case.
China's GDP reportedly grew 5.3% in the first quarter.
House Speaker Mike Johnson proposes military aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan.
Protesters demonstrate against Georgia's foreign influence law.
Europe commits to increase aid for Sudan.
The UN accuses Israel of continuing to impose unlawful restrictions on humanitarian aid.
Chinese ChatGPT rival ErnieBot claims to have over 200 million users.
A federal court overturns West Virginia's transgender sports ban.
ADL reports a 140% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in 2023.
And Copenhagen's old stock exchange catches fire.
In our first story, the Supreme Court hears arguments over January 6 prosecutions. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Fox News, and NBC. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether federal prosecutors can charge January 6 rioters under a law that prohibits manipulating a record, document, or other object so it can't be used in a government proceeding or anyone who interferes with an official proceeding. During oral arguments, which pitted U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar against Jeffrey Green, an attorney for January 6 defendant Joseph Fisher, liberal and conservative justices seemed skeptical of the government's interpretation of the law. Prelogar argued that to prosecute under this law, there has to be evidence that someone committed obstruction and did so corruptly, adding that is why only 350 out of the 1350 January 6 defendants have been charged with obstruction. Justice Neil Gorsuch asked Prelogar if a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse or pulling a fire alarm before a vote, qualify under the law. She replied that prosecutors would have to prove wrongdoing beyond a reasonable doubt, as well as intent. The obstruction charge, which carries up to 20 years in prison, has also been laid against former President Donald Trump. Lawyers for Fisher, who allegedly called for rioters to charge to the Capitol, claim the law should only apply to tampering with physical evidence. The justices are expected to rule on the case by the end of the court's term in June. If they rule against the government, some of the federal charges against Trump could be dropped.
Thanks, Melissa. On this program, we separate the spin from the facts. So those were our facts. Now for the pro-Trump narrative from Fox News. The government's argument began to fall apart the second Prelogar faced questions from the justices. While she claims the obstruction statute applies to January 6 protesters, she then admitted that it wouldn't apply to a myriad of similar protest scenarios. The holes in Prelogar's arguments will likely haunt the Department of Justice as the court considers its ruling.
And roll call brings us a Democratic narrative. The irony of tough-on-crime Republicans defending violent insurrectionists is on full display. The obstruction provision was clearly written to prohibit criminals from blocking government proceedings. Joseph Fisher is on the record saying that he would, and then physically attempting to do so. This case is cut and dry, and Republicans should support it if they're true to their principles.
And from time to time, we have nerd narratives brought to us by the Metaculous Prediction Community. This one says that Donald Trump has a 30% chance of being convicted of at least one count in his federal court cases before the end of 2024. Next up, China's GDP grows 5.3% in the first quarter. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Bloomberg, CNN, China Daily, Al Jazeera, the Financial Times, and the South China Morning Post. According to data released by China's National Bureau of Statistics on Tuesday, the PRC's gross domestic product expanded by 5.3% year over year. The country's stronger than expected growth comes after a 5.2% rise in 2023's fourth quarter, beating out the forecast of 4.6% by a Reuters poll of analysts. Compared to the previous quarter, the PRC's GDP grew 1.6%, coming in at 29.63 trillion yuan, or about $4 trillion U.S. dollars in the first quarter. The data shows that retail sales rose 4.7% in the January to March period. The Bureau said that the Chinese economy got off to a good start, with industrial output growing by 6.1%, and agricultural production and services expanding by 3.8% and 5% respectively. However, the PRC's real estate sector exhibited little sign of recovery, with property investment falling by 9.5% year-on-year in the first quarter. Moreover, exports remained weaker in dollar terms. Beijing has set a GDP growth target of about 5% for 2024. However, some economists estimate that China's economy would grow by 4.8%, reportedly due to challenges in the third and fourth quarters.
Thanks for those facts, Scott. We'll start with a pro-China narrative from China Daily. China's economy has grown faster than expected in the first 3 months of this year, despite COVID, the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and the U.S.-China trade war. Given the country's stronger-than-expected exports and manufacturing capital expenditure, and several fiscal and monetary policy measures taking effect, the PRC's second-quarter GDP would accelerate to over 5.5%, consolidating the economic recovery in 2024.
Bloomberg brings us the anti-China narrative. While China's growth has been stronger than anticipated, it's uneven. The world's second-largest economy is battling real estate crises, unemployment, deflationary pressures, weak consumer demand, and mounting government debt. Just this week alone, the blue-chip CSI 300 index has tumbled 0.5%, while the Shanghai Composite Index fell 1%. Despite the promising data, it's clear that momentum is waning in the Chinese economy.
And here's another nerd narrative from the Metaculous prediction community, saying there's a 10% chance that China's GDP will overtake the U.S. before 2030. Speaker Johnson unveils a plan for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan military aid. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Washington Post, The Guardian, The New York Post, The Associated Press, and Fox News. Representative Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, the U.S. House Speaker, on Monday unveiled a lengthy proposal to send U.S. military aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, as well as other foreign policy proposals, including seizing Russian assets and banning TikTok from the U.S. The move deviates from a Democrat-led plan passed in the Senate in February, which would have allocated $95 billion of U.S. funds for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, among other items, in one fell swoop. Johnson's plan tables the matter separately, allowing the different factions to vote based on their preferences. After a closed-door meeting with Republican lawmakers where he laid out the plans, Johnson told reporters, "The underlying text will have some of our innovation in it with regard to accountability for funding and some of these other metrics." He acknowledged that funding for Ukraine was the most difficult part of this. "I think the speaker is doing the right thing," Representative Kevin Hern, Republican of Oklahoma, chair of the Republican Study Committee, said after leaving the meeting. He said the conference needs to be able to vote on each one of those bills. After Representative Greg Stube, Republican of Florida, left the meeting, he said, quote, "I don't like it, but clearly I'm in the minority." Meanwhile, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, was threatening to oust Johnson as speaker. Her message was, "Don't fund Ukraine." Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump, the GOP candidate in this year's election, hosted Johnson at Mar-a-Lago on Friday. In a joint press event, Trump said he was considering Johnson's proposal to loan Ukraine military aid rather than donate it as a gift.
Thanks, Melissa. We have a Republican narrative on this story from the New York Post. Representative Mike Johnson's approach here is the right one to take. By splitting up items into individual portfolios, members of Congress will each be able to vote on the matters that best serve the interests of each of their individual constituencies. This was a courageous move by the House Speaker.
And The Guardian brings us a Democratic narrative. Rather than trying to vote through the Democrat-led plan that would have immediately approved $95 billion in military aid, Representative Mike Johnson has instead come up with this complex alternative in an effort to keep his squabbling Republican lawmakers happy. While they're baying for his blood, there's no guarantee it'll succeed.
And another nerd narrative from Metaculous, there's a 7% chance that there will be a war between Russia and one or more NATO countries, but not the U.S. by 2035. Protesters demonstrate against the Georgian foreign influence law. Here are the facts. As agreed upon by DW, Reuters, Euronews, Al Jazeera, ABC News, and BBC News. Large protests took place outside the Georgian parliament in the capital, Tbilisi, on Monday against a draft law on foreign influence allegedly modeled on Russian legislation to crack down on dissent. Over 5,000 protesters reportedly took to the streets demanding withdrawal of the bill dubbed the Russian Law by critics, with 14 protesters detained for public order violations and one police officer injured, according to Georgia's Interior Ministry. The bill, drafted by the ruling Georgian Dream Party, is a slightly modified version of the former foreign agents proposal, which was criticized by the EU and the US and dropped last year after widespread protests. The legislation reportedly requires media and non-commercial organizations to register as pursuing the interests of a foreign power if they receive more than 20% of their budget from abroad. During a speech in favor of the bill, the leader of the ruling Georgian Dream Party, Mamuka Midinaradze, was punched in the face by opposition member of parliament Aleko Ilashvili. The incident led to a brawl involving several lawmakers, while President Salome Zurabichvili is reportedly expected to veto the bill should it pass in parliament. His term ends this year, after which all members of parliament will vote on her successor.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts. Here's The Spin, starting with a pro-establishment narrative from Civil Georgia. The latest protests are impressive proof that Georgians prefer a democratic and prosperous future within the Euro-Atlantic family to the regressive Moscow-style autocratic model. By merely renaming the foreign agents bill, Tbilisi is breaching its commitment to scrap its threat to press freedom ahead of the upcoming elections. The infamous law must be withdrawn immediately to prevent jeopardizing Georgia's EU integration.
The establishment critical narrative comes from RT. Contrary to what Western media suggests, it's not the Georgian people protesting against the bill, but the followers of the Western-backed opposition. It should also be noted that the so-called Russian law is not inspired by Russian legislation, but rather by the 1938 U.S. Foreign Agents Act, though the Georgian equivalent is far more limited. The West has nothing to offer but empty promises, and it's up to Georgians to decide which path to take.
And the nerds have another say. This time there's a 5% chance that Georgia will control South Ossetia and Abkhazia before 2028. Europe commits to an aid increase on Sudan's war anniversary. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, Euronews, El País, and the Los Angeles Times. European officials met in France on Monday to discuss humanitarian aid for Sudan, a year after the country plunged into a civil war that claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock announced that Germany will provide 244 million euros in aid and called on other European countries to pledge funds, warning that 1 million Sudanese might die of hunger this year. The UN aims to raise about $2.7 billion for humanitarian aid this year. So far, only $145 million, or around 5% of the target, has been raised. According to UN estimates, some 37% of the population is starving. UN Commissioner for Crisis Management, Yanez Lenerchich, said the bloc wants to ensure that Sudan is not forgotten, adding that the country became one of the worst humanitarian disasters in African history. Some 25 million Sudanese, more than half of them children, are in urgent need of aid, and famine declaration reportedly seems imminent. The war triggered the world's largest internal displacement crisis, with some 8.5 million Sudanese displaced in total. While members of Sudanese civil society were present at the Paris conference, neither the Sudanese army nor the rival Rapid Support Forces were represented. In the year-long war, over 14,000 people have been killed and at least 33,000 injured.
Thanks, Melissa. Relief Web brings us the pro-establishment narrative. Given the humanitarian disaster in Sudan, financial aid is essential but not enough. An immediate ceasefire and peaceful and negotiated political settlement are at least as important. Furthermore, it's necessary to exert pressure on the warring parties to ensure that they grant humanitarian organizations safe access to the delivery of humanitarian aid.
And here's an establishment critical narrative from the Los Angeles Times. It's telling that no concrete commitments were made in Paris to alleviate the Sudanese nightmare. Famine is a reality in Sudan, and the international indifference compared to Gaza and Ukraine is a disgrace. If humanitarian values are still valid, the international community must immediately provide the funding needed to prevent an even greater catastrophe.
And another nerd narrative from Attaculous, there's a 50% chance that at least 45.6% of people will use the internet in Africa in 2025. The UN says Israel is still imposing unlawful restrictions on humanitarian aid. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by the Associated Press, Politico, The Times of Israel, Al Jazeera, Axios, and Reuters. The UN Human Rights Office said on Tuesday that Israel still has unlawful restrictions on humanitarian aid intended for Gaza in place and is still carrying out widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure. Israel and the U.S. have recently argued that aid flows into Gaza have expanded. Regarding Iran's attack over the weekend, Secretary of State Antony Blinken told American Jewish leaders on Tuesday that further escalation with Iran is not in the interests of either the U.S. or Israel, but the U.S. would never tell Israel what to do. As concerns over regional tensions and Gaza's humanitarian situation continue, Israeli forces advanced into regions of northern Gaza on Tuesday, from which it had withdrawn in recent weeks. Residents who had returned to Jabalia and Beit Hanoun after Israeli withdrawals reportedly fled due to the new Israeli raids. As the raids occurred, Israeli media reported rocket fire from northern Gaza targeting Niram near the border fence. The military said the rockets hit open areas, causing no injuries or damage. Meanwhile, Hamas and Egyptian officials reported on Sunday that the armed group had called for a clear written commitment that Israel will withdraw from the Gaza Strip during the second of a three-phase ceasefire deal. Israel said Hamas had rejected its most recent proposal for a temporary ceasefire and hostage release deal. One of the main points of contention in negotiations has reportedly been the return of displaced Palestinians to their homes in northern Gaza, something Israel has rejected. Witnesses and medical authorities in Gaza said that Israeli forces killed five people on Sunday when they tried to enter the north.
Thank you, Scott, for the facts. We'll start this round of narratives with a pro-establishment narrative from CNN. The U.S. is doing everything it can to ensure that Israel deter military threats while also preventing regional escalation. Israel must be able to defend itself from terrorist attacks, whether from Gaza or elsewhere, and the U.S. will always defend Israel's right to security. Nonetheless, it is not in the U.S. or Israel's best interest to see the conflict escalate. Thankfully, Israel, with the assistance of the U.S. and its regional allies, managed to effectively counter Iran's attack, and any further military actions are completely unnecessary.
Middle East Eye counters with a pro-Palestine narrative. Israel is losing the war in Gaza. After over 6 months, Israel has failed to effectively achieve any of its goals and has only made itself more insecure. Even if Israel managed to realize its vision for Gaza, there's a high likelihood that Israel would still be in a worse position than it was before October 7th. By destroying Gaza and starving its people, all Israel has done is isolate itself and increase the danger it is in by purposefully escalating regional tensions.
Here's the pro-Israel narrative from the Jerusalem Post. Though, of course, this war has not been easy, the situation has now come to a head, and Israel must act decisively. For too long, Israel has been reluctant to appropriately respond to Iran and its terrorist proxies. Now, however, Iran's recent attack demonstrates that Israel's position in the region, specifically the Arab world, is stronger than ever. Israel must act decisively, but intelligently, to deter Iranian aggression.
And a pro-Iran narrative from Al-Mayadeen. Iran continues to demonstrate its capabilities and restraint, as the attack over the weekend will openly serve as a wake-up call to Israel to end this series of escalations. Iran and its allies have been clear from day one that they do not want to see this war spiral into a regional conflict. Rather, Iran only seeks to end Israel's crimes in Gaza, to which it has been forced to respond. Israel made a mistake in believing that Iran would not retaliate over its provocations, and Iran will continue to calculate its moves appropriately.
And finally, the nerds have a say from the Metaculous Prediction Community. There's a 25% chance that there will be 1,000 or more deaths due to armed conflict between Israel and Hezbollah before 2025. ChatGPT's rival ErnieBot claims it has over 200 million users. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CNBC, Tech Times, El Blog, Reuters, and Al Jazeera. Baidu, a Beijing-based internet company, said Tuesday that its ErnieBot artificial intelligence chatbot has over 200 million users since its launch in 2023 and handles more than 50 million daily queries. Baidu's chief executive officer, Robin Li, claimed that ChatGPT's Chinese rival has doubled its user base since December, remaining the PRC's most popular AI chatbot. In addition, Ernie has about 85,000 enterprise clients, with Baidu reportedly earning hundreds of millions of yuan by using AI in its advertising services. Ernie, released to the public last August, is China's first locally developed chatbot. However, domestic rivals such as the Alibaba-backed Kimi chatbot have reportedly been growing faster. Kimi's visits surged 321.6% in March, while Ernie's rose 48%. However, Chinese chatbots trail their Western rivals. ChatGPT alone had 1.86 billion views last month. China has reportedly approved up to 117 large AI models, indicating its eagerness to establish a firm presence in the rapidly evolving field.
Thanks, Melissa. We have a pro-China narrative on this story from El Blog. Ernie's surge showcases Baidu's AI commitment. Its success mirrors the world's increasing reliance on AI, which is shaping digital communications' future. Chinese companies like Baidu, Tencent, and Alibaba invest heavily in AI, expecting market growth despite challenges like data security, ethics, and linguistic nuances. China's chatbot sector is expanding by leaps and bounds.
Politico brings us an anti-China narrative. The U.S. and Europe must take the prospect of China's rise in the AI sector seriously. Failing to do so could mean a global community structured to be dependent on AI systems, which could tilt non-aligned nations into Beijing's orbit and give a dangerous authoritarian bent to the evolution of the technology. Western powers must counteract the PRC's troubling ascent in the AI arena.
Narrative C comes from Sixth Tone. China and the U.S. must increasingly engage in an AI dialogue, which is crucial for navigating the field's future challenges. Collaboration between industry and academia is vital, though it will be complex due to competition and governance concerns. Prioritizing AI safety remains a global imperative. Washington and Beijing must put aside geopolitical rivalries to mitigate the risks.
And the nerds from Metaculus have a spin on this as well, saying there's a 38% chance that the U.S. will restrict Chinese AI developers' access to U.S. cloud computing before 2025. Scott, if you had a chatbot to name, what would you name it?
Man, I mean, ErnieBot's pretty good. I got to say, that's a good name because I know. So Ernie, good name.
Yeah.
But. And
think
it's evocative,
Ernie, right?
Of course, it's evocative of our Ernie, Bert and Ernie. But I feel like Ernie's not at the tip of the cultural tongue anymore. You know, Elmo has long since usurped the head spot.
It still has a pleasant feel, though, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Ernie's a pleasant one.
Ernie's Ernie, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like it's time for an Ernie resurgence, the name, so that's good. And then the fact that it's just ErnieBot, okay, we get it. It's a chatbot, like we got it, you know.
Right.
So that ErnieBot's a good name.
It seems like two syllables is good, right? Kimmy, Ernie.
I mean,
it's
honestly,
like they're kind of cute.
Honest to God,
right?
Topshirbot, not the worst name in the world. You could do a lot worse than Topshirbot. A West Virginia court rejects the law banning transgender athletes in women's sports. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Courthouse News Service, Associated Press, CBS, Fox News, NBC, and The Hill. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a West Virginia law that prohibited transgender athletes from competing in sports designated for women and girls at public schools and colleges. In a 2-1 ruling, a panel of appellate judges found that West Virginia's Save Women's Sports Act violated the 14th Amendment and Title IX protections. The case centers around a 13-year-old transgender girl, Becky Pepper Jackson. West Virginia passed a bill requiring school-sanctioned sports to be organized by biological sex in 2021, prompting the American Civil Liberties Union of West Virginia to file a lawsuit on behalf of Jackson. Jackson has been taking puberty blockers since the third grade, and in February, the court blocked West Virginia from removing the student from a middle school track and field team. West Virginia is among 24 states with laws against transgender athletes from competing in women's sports. Judge Toby Haytens, a Biden appointee, says that the law violates the Equal Protection Clause and Title IX because it only applies to transgender girls. The majority also noted that Jackson had never gone through puberty and did not have a biological advantage. The court noted that the ruling focuses on the nuances of this specific case and other states are still able to have their respective laws on the issue.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts. We'll start the spin for the left narrative from American Civil Liberties Union. This ruling is a victory for the civil rights and dignity of transgender athletes across the U.S., and hopefully it will serve as a catalyst for similar decisions. Many states are trying to deny trans people of simply existing in the gender with which they identify. And West Virginia's law sought to deprive a transgender girl of her right to compete with her friends on a middle school track team.
The right narrative spin from Daily Wire. The Fourth Circuit dealt a blow to women's sports, fairness, and common sense by striking down West Virginia's law that required biological women to compete in women's sports. The left should not be arguing that biological males should be able to compete against biological females. Women and girls are the biggest losers today in this major cultural issue.
And here's the nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 50% chance that at least 13.5% of American adults will identify as LGBTQ in 2070. The ADL reports a 140% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in 2023. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Reuters, CNN, the ADL, and the Inquirer. The Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, reported that it counted 8,873 anti-Semitic incidents in 2023, a 140% increase from 2022. The figures were released Tuesday as part of the group's annual report of instances on anti-Semitism. The advocacy group reportedly tracked incidents such as harassment, vandalism, and assault, while noting that it detected the highest number of anti-Jewish acts since it started tracking such data in 1979. A 184% increase in harassment drove the vast majority of the 2023 increase, with 6,535 reported incidents. However, the ADL tracked increases in assault, 161 reported incidents, and vandalism, 2,177 reported incidents. The group noted that most of the incidents, 5,204, occurred after Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th, and the group notes that 52% of the post-October 7 incidents included references to Israel, Zionism, or Palestine. The ADL defines harassment as instances when a Jewish person or persons, or someone perceived as Jewish, is harassed with anti-Semitic slurs and stereotypes. After the war in Gaza broke out, it updated its methodology to include opposition to Zionism or the State of Israel. The report was prepared in January and doesn't include incidents that have occurred in 2024, though many believe that the trend that started after October 7 has continued into this year.
The Hill brings us the pro-Israel narrative. Anti-Semitism has always been a uniquely reprehensible form of hatred, and it is disheartening that levels of anti-Jewish attacks reached an all-time high in 2023. Since Israel was brutally attacked by Hamas on October 7th, the Jewish community across the world, but especially in the U.S., has been subjected to a horrific increase in anti-Semitic harassment, both in the form of anti-Jewish and anti-Israel messaging. This unacceptable uptick must be addressed, especially given the turbulent global times.
Here's the pro-Palestine narrative from The Intercept. The ADL has abandoned its core mission to fight against hatred and bigotry of marginalized groups, aligning itself instead with the geopolitical goals of Israel. Going against Israel's occupation of Palestine and its ongoing attack on Gaza is not anti-Semitic and should not be labeled as such. Showing solidarity with the Palestinian people, even by anti-war Jewish voices, is now off-limits by the ADL's new criteria, which is dangerous misrepresentation.
And the right narrative spin from Revolver. For decades, the ADL has smeared anyone to the right of the Democratic Party as every form of ist in the book, and now it is turning its ire to those on the left who are supporting Palestine. The ADL has long engaged in rhetoric that is unfair and that fights against free speech, and finally, people across the political spectrum can now see that.
Here's another nerd narrative from the Metaculous community saying there's a 40% chance that Iran will recognize Israel before 2070.
Our final story, fire engulfs Copenhagen's old stock exchange. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by the Copenhagen Post, the Associated Press, CNN, The Wall Street Journal, European Conservative, and BBC News. A large-scale fire engulfed one of the most famous and oldest buildings in Copenhagen, the historic 17th-century Børsen, on Tuesday, causing its iconic spire to collapse. According to the Greater Copenhagen Fire Department, the blaze that destroyed nearly half of the building began in the morning on the roof, where renovation works were underway. Police have yet to determine the cause. The fire was only declared under control in the afternoon, as the area under the old copper roof was almost inaccessible. The scaffolding also made it harder for emergency services to extinguish the flames. Staff and passerby citizens worked together with emergency services to rescue Renaissance paintings and other art treasures from the inferno. There have been no reports of injuries so far. A popular tourist and cultural attraction in the city center, the now burned building, has housed the Danish Chamber of Commerce since the stock exchange moved premises in the 1970s. This tragedy is reminiscent of the disaster at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, which was also destroyed in the flames 5 years ago. While the facades of the Børsen building are still standing, there's no guarantee they can be saved.
Thank you for those sad facts, Scott. We'll start the spins with a narrative A from the Daily Mail. Even though firefighters and ordinary citizens managed to salvage lots of historic objects from the fire, this incident has become a horrific cultural disaster, as the building itself was an important part of Danish architectural heritage, as well as a centuries-old landmark for Copenhagen. This is a sad day for the nation.
And narrative B from the Financial Times. Similar to incidents at Notre Dame in Paris and Windsor Castle, among other irreplaceable monuments that previously raged in fire, what happened in Copenhagen's old stock exchange must be understood as not the end, but rather as an opportunity for transformation and renewal after a period of mourning. Though sad, it's a relief that no lives have been lost. I wonder, on a building that is historic, its very existence is historic, where fire remediation comes in and what kind of compromises they make.
I'm sure if there's a human safety issue, if you're going to allow people, the public, there probably does have to be some kind of upgrade.
Because at some point, if you put in too much weird remediation, you like ruin the building or something.
I think there does have to. Yes, there like a lot of the codes in Washington, at least, are like if it's a historic building, there have to be like life safety issues into it, but you don't have to build an ADA accessible ramp into it, right? That's old enough. But I think you do have to retrofit, if you're going to upgrade something, you do have to retrofit for earthquakes, you know, in this area.
And then that probably makes people not want to upgrade. I used to work at Husky Stadium at University of Washington, and now there's a whole new Husky Stadium, so the point is moot. But for many years, they couldn't make improvements to Husky Stadium, like simple stuff, because if you change something, then it had to be up to a code far beyond what was required for the historic building. Then you start putting off improvements that would have been safer because you can't justify the cost of the thing. So it becomes like a weird, anytime there's some kind of rules put over top of something arbitrarily, then there's always going to be weird inefficiencies that come about.
Across the street from us, there is it's called the Landmark. It was an old Masonic lodge. And, you know, if you donated to the Masons, it was basically a retirement home. Like,
oh, nice.
You know, all your savings went to support the Masonic lodge. And then you live there and it's just gorgeous. Like 5-6-story building. It's kind of like in a V shape, right? And it's got this beautiful view of Puget Sound. And it hasn't been maintained in years and years and years because it's got this historic label, right? Now, nobody can buy it because they're like, well, you can't tear it down. It's historic. Yeah, but if it costs me twice as much, like I will lose money on buying this and retrofitting it into a hotel.
Paul Allen, RIP, or someone would have to decide it's their own personal project, but it's completely impractical. Probably a lawsuit waiting to happen.
Yeah.
And all that. all that stuff.
Yeah, it'd be a big loss. You'd be pouring money into it as a heartfelt gesture, you know. So it's like, okay, well, eventually someone's going to have to give, and they're going to tear this thing down and turn it into new development, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the historic. I mean, I kind of like what Italy does, Rome, like the Colosseum. You just go in, you can touch whatever, do whatever. They put sidewalks in it, like they're just using it. They're using it, you know, like they're not putting plastic covers on their couches. Just use the couches, and there they are. You know, you can walk through the Colosseum, and they just like put cement down so you can walk. Like, let's just put a sidewalk in the Colosseum. Seems crazy to Americans. Like, no, we would put a rope around it and not let anyone inside.
Yeah, don't touch it. Thomas Jefferson ate at that table.
That's right.
Don't touch it.
And don't ask who he was eating with at all. Please, no. Do not. We don't want to get into any details whatsoever.
Thank you for listening to the Verity Podcast for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers and figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
To find out more about Verity, visit our website, verity.news, or download our app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Melissa Topshire, inviting you to join us next time on Verity.